There is no doubt that there is an organized gang distributing zombie takeout to students.
What's up? Welcome to episode 321 of Zombie Takeout.
Zombie Takeout.
The B-movie and cult movie podcast. I'm Uncle John.
And I'm Scotto.
And before we get started this week, just a couple of, a correction and a note from last week.
God damn, we fucked up.
Well, slightly. You mentioned that there was no Doom or Wolfenstein movie. You lamented the fact that there were none. There was a Doom movie.
Really?
It starred The Rock. It was horrible. You may remember there was a section in First Person. It was from, 2010.
No, this is... I'm drawing a blank entirely. I can't even believe...
For the best.
I can't even believe there was a Rock movie that didn't get, press.
It was bad. We might just add it to the list just so you can see the horror. They actually tried First Person for, 20 minutes of it.
I mean, think about it. He's done some real shit movies. Mm-hmm. I mean, movies that you don't even have to see to know their shit, like Return to Witch Mountain or whatever the hell that was.
I actually did see that one. It wasn't horrible. It was kind of, it had its moments. It wasn't good, but it did have its entertaining moments. I'm thinking more like The Scorpion King and, The Mummy movies.
Oh, well, yeah. But you've heard, I mean, those are,
pretty well known.
That get a lot of press and stuff. I mean, even Return to Witch Mountain had press. Whatever he does.
Yeah. Doom got some press, particularly some bad press for the first-person section.
So is it like that, what was that, Hardcore Harry movie, which we should have on our list too?
I don't think I saw that one.
Where they do, I think they do the whole thing first-person.
Oh my, that's, wow. And just one other note, the Just Shoot Me reference that you dropped last week.
Oh, thank you.
Not only killed me last week while we were recording... Killed me again when I was editing. I had to stop editing and find the clip on YouTube to watch it.
Well, I mean, it was pretty obvious. I mean, the Two Towers? What could it be?
It fit perfectly.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was such an underrated show, by the way.
It was.
And on to some listener submitted. This is from Bodo on Twitter. In reference to last week's episode, he said... Mazes of Monsters is anti-D&D, anti-Broken Home, and most of all, anti-writing, acting, and TV movie. He also said, if you guys want to make Zombievers into an animal zombie trilogy, you can do Pet Sematary and the Great Zombies. Now, my initial reaction to this was, we've done quite a few trilogies and two-parters this year, and I kind of want to stick to standalones. But then I watched the trailer for Zombies. I don't know about Pet Sematary, but we have to do Zombies.
It sounds like something in our wheelhouse, yeah?
It's Asylum.
Oh.
About a zoo where the animals become undead.
It has been a long time since we've done an Asylum film, I think, right?
Except for Sharknado, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's all we've been doing over the last few years, or just Sharknado.
It's been a while since we've done a non-Sharknado. Asylums. I think Aztec Rex was the last one.
Wow.
We're due.
Lampreys or,
I think, it's one of those two, whichever was most recent. It's been a while. We're due. And Zombies looks awesome.
That sounds like something I cannot wait for.
And finally, Bodo recommended the Dungeon Delve podcast. It's the official D&D podcast from, Wizards of the Coast. I had a chance to listen to it tonight for a few minutes. There's a lot of humor. They don't take it seriously, which it really should be the case with D&D, You don't want to get too overwrought with that sort of thing. Unless you're going camp with it. Like on Critical Role, they go very campy with it. Speaking of the two I recommended last week, and I think this also applies probably to Dungeon Delve, you don't need to start at the first episode at the beginning of the campaign. You can jump into the latest episode, and by the end of the session, you will understand the characters and the story.
Yeah, the first levels are usually pretty boring in any campaign, I think.
And with Critical Role, they didn't even start filming until about a year or two into the campaign. So, you know, that initial meeting was never filmed. But I jumped in on episode 89 of Critical Role, and by the end of the session, I got enough to understand what was going on and continue with it.
I mean, one campaign I did do where I was like, how do you make that first level interesting where it's like, you guys can barely do anything but just the basic, oh, there's a goblin. Okay, so I'm going to, you know, fight the goblin and get some experience. What I did was I had really high level arch villains that I came up with that, of course, they wouldn't stand a chance against. I had them trolling the party for the first, where they couldn't do anything about them. Just to get under their skin and just to, like, you know, come, you know, appear and taunt and, you know, have them have this whole story arc about them against this arc villain and getting, you know, getting their power to fight them.
Mm-hmm. Also, I mentioned when I posted about those shows on our social networks that Critical Role was much more about role play and less about rolling. And there's no maps or, you know, miniatures or anything. I said that. And then in the next episode, they rolled initiative 3 times and brought out the maps and the miniatures and everything.
Well, wait a minute. You always have to roll initiative.
I started in 89. That episode started with a fight. I don't think they rolled initiative again until 93.
Really?
There were like 3 or 4 sessions where they did not roll initiative.
I mean, I know, you know, you don't have to do like the metal figures and stuff, although sometimes that can be fun because then you can do like a tactical kind of thing of how you're going to approach something. Mm. But I mean, you got to roll initiative if you're going to have a fight.
The two shows that I watch are vastly different in that sense. On High Rollers, they roll initiative 2 or 3 times per episode, per session. Critical Role, like I said, they went 3 or 4 episodes without it. It was just pure roleplay.
Odd, all right.
And ironically, the next one after I say that they don't really, you know, use miniatures, they roll initiative 3 times. It was the end of an arc, you know, so they were up against a couple of bosses.
Okay.
Really tense. They almost wiped at one point and, like, ended the campaign. Anyway.
Wow.
On to this week's movie, which is from...
tense.
From 1936 or 1938 or 1939. It's a little unclear. Reefer Madness. Of course, that brings us to the impromptu plot summary, sponsored by Propaganda. It's not a lie if you believe it.
And also brought to you by Bad Movies. Failing this, the next tragedy may be that of your daughters, or your sons, or yours, or yours. The drama queen. Anyway, we have this, we have an upstanding community in Brooklyn, New York. And a guy with an accent that I can't quite place anywhere.
Dr. Carroll.
It could be Harvard. It could be England. It could be Brooklyn.
It's the old school mid-Atlantic that they always did in movies back then.
It could be Connecticut.
Mm-hmm. I think it's meant to sound like New England-ish, but it really does kind of come off old English.
I mean, if this guy had still been alive in the 70s, Peter Cushing completely stole his role. Anyway.
Except he can speak with an authentic British accent.
Yeah, he can. And act. So we have this upstanding community in Brooklyn, New York. We're pretty much spoken to for the first 7 minutes, though. Yeah. I mean, we're pretty much outright lectured. Mm-hmm. About the dangers and you know, all I keep thinking about was the Monty Python movie where the crowd is yelling, get on with it.
And to be fair, the scene was a lecture.
Well, right.
It wasn't just talking to camera at a desk. You know, it was actually a lecture scene.
Yeah. Well, I mean, come on. They were lecture gods.
Mm-hmm. Well, first.
So.
And when he turned the camera, it was creepy.
After we finally get to the story, there are these kids, they're innocent, they're having fun, but then there's this seedy element. One of the kids is from a broken home, though, of course. You don't want to hang out with him. His parents just got divorced. Anyway, so they are lured from this soda shop to this apartment where they smoke a different kind of cigarettes. You see, it's okay to smoke the tobacco cigarettes.
Middle-aged men partying with teenagers. They're lucky they were just weed dealers.
What's the worst that could happen? Well, they really weren't just weed dealers. But
I'm saying it could have been worse.
They try to pretty much come up with all the different ways that they could possibly get in trouble. One kid kills someone in a hit and run. And some people are just laughing for no reason, of course.
Probably the only realistic thing about the movie.
That's true. The laughter is the only thing. Everything else seemed like they were on PCP rather than marijuana. But except for the laughter, maybe, which probably could also happen on PCP too. I don't know.
Well, I have no idea.
The girlfriend of our hero finally is lured up into this sordid thing, place of, I want to say ill repute, but there was no prostitution going on.
Well, it's still ill repute. It's just, that's a euphemism for prostitution, but you know.
Yeah. And, of course, she winds up getting shot, because that's what happens when you apparently hang out with people who smoke weed.
It's really more an indictment of weed dealers than the kids.
Well, yeah.
It's a literal indictment at the end.
Luring these kids into this sordid lifestyle. So of course the trial is going on for the rest of the movie.
I thought it was going to turn into 12 Angry Men for a minute there.
It did look that way. Which, oddly enough, the kid had no defending attorney for some reason. Because you only heard the prosecution side. Mm-hmm. Never mind about how there had to have been other people there. Why are there no witnesses? And he's found guilty. And that's not a spoiler, because that doesn't necessarily mean that's what's going to happen in the end here. Right. Because all the witnesses are being sequestered by the, I guess you could call them mob guys. The gangsters, I guess.
They were gangsters.
Not gangsters either.
No.
They had
for that.
They had the ER at the end of their occupation. So they were being sequestered while the trial was going on. So there were no witnesses. I really don't understand why, though, because why would they incriminate themselves anyway? So why would you need to hold anybody up? And of course they crack. All hell breaks loose, and I guess you could just say hilarity ensues.
Now, in 1936 or 1938, again, the year is dubious, this movie, originally called Tell Your Children, was financed and made by a church group and intended to be shown to parents as a morality tale, attempting to teach them about the dangers of cannabis use. However, sometime after it was made, it was purchased by exploitation filmmaker Dwayne Esper, who inserted salacious shots. In 1938 or 1939, Esper began distributing it on the exploitation circuit, where it was originally released in four territories, each with its own title. Those four titles being The Burning Question, Dope Addict, Doped Youth, and Love Madness. In New England, it was known as Reefer Madness, which is where the title comes from.
All right.
So this version that we've seen was actually not the original. It was still the doctored version.
Really?
And I wasn't sure until the trial at the end. Actually, the just before the sentencing, there's this shot of people's eyes that just comes out of nowhere.
Yeah, that didn't belong.
That had to be an insert from Dwayne Esper.
Did it, though? Because, I mean, it there seemed to be a lot of... Whoever made this did not know what they were doing, really. I mean, there were horrible edits.
Well, and I think, as I have in my notes, the toking pianist, this piano player who just kind of sneaks off and tokes up, and then you get a couple other shots of him. He's not in the story. He never has any dialogue. He's just really there for the stereotype of the toking musician. And toking, not token. And I think that was also an insert by Esper.
Is that really what he would insert in there, though? I would think he would have more salacious things to put in.
Well, that was the 30s. That was salacious.
Yeah, I guess it's hard to tell what was salacious in the 1930s. Yeah.
the movie starts with a crawl. A movie that starts with a crawl can't be all bad.
Well, it's like the original Star Wars almost. Mm.
Also, I think a lot of the acting, to be honest, was better than the movie. Most of the gangsters were good, acting-wise. And I kind of liked Dr. Carroll's performance. I mean, it was over the top, but it was fun. It was very Jeffrey Combs.
I was wondering how I was going to, you know, thank God this was a short movie. I mean.
Wow.
Because his performance alone was just, it was just dreadful. It was just, like, just to be locked in a room with a guy like that, just blathering on.
Well, I didn't like the character, but I bought the performance.
But that's the problem. There wasn't much of a performance there. He was mostly just reading. Obviously reading.
And in the middle of that lecture, he basically explains how joints are made and how to traffic drugs. Because he talks about, you know, cocaine and heroin and, you know, harder drugs being trafficked in watches and shoes and all these places that people can hide them. And then they show a joint being rolled. And I'm wondering if those inserts were... Well, the inserts could have been put in by Esper, but the dialogue about, you know, how heroin and cocaine were trafficked was said by the actor who played Dr. Carroll. So that had to be.
I really don't know what could have been inserted into this. I mean, for the version we saw, at least. Aside from the scene where he's with the older woman, you know, before the murder. Mm-hmm. There really wasn't a whole lot that was salacious before that. And maybe a little bit of the murder scene itself, but those were pretty essential to the plot.
Well, no, those weren't inserted because those were the actors who were in the whole movie. So yeah. They couldn't have been inserted years later by this, you know, other filmmaker.
Now, the crazy eye scene, that was the mob boss at the end, I think.
But it was just this random picture of just people's eyes. Or like three people. They were close-ups.
It was very weird.
Yeah.
It was kind of like, what? What is this?
And I think we come down on opposite sides of this, because I'll just say it, I loved this movie. It was so much fun. Particularly Bill, the guy who ends up getting framed for murder. He was just so incredibly camp.
Well, yeah. He's just a square guy.
Like, if I were going to recast the role... You know, go back about 20, 30 years, I would put Jim J. Bullock in the role. It's that, like, that's how he kind of came across. And I found out that Riff Trax actually did this. Mike Nelson specifically riffed on it. But I hope MSG3K does it next season. It's public domain, so.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The concept of aftermarket films, film distribution had not yet been developed, especially for films that existed outside the confines of the studio system. And they were therefore considered forbidden fruit. For this reason, neither Esper nor original producer George Hurlman bothered to protect the film's copyright. Over 30 years later, in the spring of 72, the founder of Normal, Kevin Straub, found a copy in the Library of Congress archive and bought the print for $297. As part of a fundraising campaign, Normal... The National Organization for Marijuana Law Reformation, I'm not sure, I think I botched that order, showed Reefer Madness on college campuses up and down California. Robert Shea of New Line Cinema eventually heard about the underground hit and went to see it on Bleecker Street. He noticed the film carried an improper copyright notice and realized that it was in the public domain. Seeking material for New Line's college circuit, this is in the 70s, he was able to obtain an original copy from a collector and began distributing it nationally, making a small fortune for New Line. This was mocked before it was even released as a straight film, both by Esper and in the 70s by Shea.
Well, of course it was mocked. I mean, you just see this and it's kind of, it's really the beginning of the erosion of our trust in, I don't know, you could almost say the government. I mean,
well, it was just a moral panic movie put together by a church group.
Because, I mean, the fact that the FBI guy just, sure, take these files. It's like, wait, what?
Well, I've seen, you know, more unrealistic things in movies from that era, in good movies from that era. I don't think they were really concerned with procedure.
Right, though, but think about that.
It's right in the title. They have an agenda.
That level of corruption, though. Like, oh, yeah, sure. Knock yourself out with those files.
And I also like how it sort of deviated from its own plot here and there. It would just throw in random scenes that made no sense. We have the scene with Mary and Bill, and suddenly we go to this other unrelated scene with these two other people. And it just kind of meandered that way throughout the film.
Yeah, you're just following these kids around, and then it was a stream of consciousness.
Almost. Yeah, very much so, which I loved. Also, apparently root beer is different from soda, according to them.
You're right, that didn't make any sense either.
Unless it was a regional thing where soda was Coke, you know, cola.
I never touched this stuff, but I'll have some root beer. I thought they'd stopped putting cocaine in the cola
way before this. It was way before this. I don't know. To me, this is like almost a better unintentional comedy than The Room. I mean, I actually think it might be better than The Room.
I thought the piano player was Wizzo, actually.
Yeah. There was certainly a resemblance. Also, I've seen so many clips of this in 80s videos.
Oh, really?
There were several shots throughout the movie that reminded me of things I'd seen in music videos, particularly, I think, a couple of Oingo Boingo videos. And given that it's public domain, that makes perfect sense. You know, they could use the footage easily.
There was sort of, you know, like a Forbidden Zone sort of thing, too.
Yeah, yeah, very much so. And I have to wonder why the dealers weren't getting high off the secondhand smoke. Because they were all sitting around this apartment and the kids were smoking up. The dealers were perfectly sober.
Yeah, they seemed to just smoke a little bit. They were in control. My bigger question was, how much money could there have been in weed in the 30s, though? I mean, enough to support a house, a fake
it
bar?
It was still pretty big back then. I mean, people associate it with the hippies in the 60s and whatnot. But before that, it was infamous for being used by jazz musicians before rock and roll existed. Right, you know, it does go back a long time.
How much money could there have been in it, though? I mean, they sold bottles of Coke for like a nickel.
Well, but I mean, nickel in 1936 money was, you know, probably comparable to what it costs now.
We made a whole $2 last night.
It was never going to be a realistic movie, again, made by a church group with an agenda and probably not much money. Although this was inspired by the case of Victor Licata, who killed his father, mother, and two brothers with an axe, and sister with an axe in Tampa, Florida in 1933, allegedly while under the influence of marijuana. Declared unfit to stand trial, subsequent psychiatric examination at the Florida State Mental Hospital determined that Licata suffered from schizophrenia with homicidal tendencies.
No.
The case was propagandized and used for the passage of the Marijuana Tax Act in 1937 that effectively outlawed weed.
So that's a story they brought up at the beginning when they're reading the files. Mm-hmm. Those are one of the files that he, you know, just lets him walk off with. You seem like a smart man. Take the files.
It kind of seems like you were expecting this to be a good movie.
And not really, of course. But I mean, you've got to call out what they've done.
Yeah, to me, that just adds to the charm and the fun of it. It's, you know, like when the prosecutor was pointing at the end. Well, not the end, but, you know, after the killing. He kind of reminded me of Darth Vader, you know, however he points after the line.
I thought it was more of a Hitler thing, but
yeah, okay, I can see that. I was also really surprised that there was half the movie left when Mary died. To me, that seemed like kind of the climax.
You would think that, but you got to have a trial. Well, yeah, I mean, yeah. There was a thing back in the Roosevelt era where, you know, contractually they had to have, you know, the crime doesn't pay thing.
Mm-hmm, right.
Like, in fact, did you notice when they were showing headlines that some of the other lesser headlines in the newspaper, one is for like Dick Tracy and the G-Men,
okay,
breaking up some sort of gangster, you know, hideout or whatever.
Makes sense, you know, that Dick Tracy was of that era. There was one moment that seemed particularly odd. Ralph, the more evil of the two dealers, was telling Blanche to play piano faster.
Right.
It almost started to border on fetish porn. Like, he was definitely, like, getting off on how fast she was flying.
Well, first off, I mean, she obviously wasn't flying.
Well, of course. Well, yeah.
I'm not sure, like,
she was miming exactly. It very comedically.
Right. Yeah, I'm not sure exactly his whole character in the first place. It's just these crazy mood swings of his.
Yeah, he's the bad guy. He's the bad guy of bad guys.
Yeah.
He's the one who attempts to rape Mary. He's the one who accidentally shoots her, you know, and he's the one who's sentenced at the end.
Well, no, let's see. The guy that shoots her is the one that's in control.
Well, no.
Wants to, you know, wants to quiet.
No, Ralph is the bad guy. Jack was the other one, the good one, so to speak. Kind of good. Ralph was the one who attempted to rape her.
And, right. Exactly.
And Bill was struggling with him when she got shot. I mean, I'm assuming Ralph's hand was on the gun since he's the one who pulled it out. And Ralph was the one who got sentenced at the end because he's the one who shot her.
Was that Ralph at the end?
Yeah.
That guy actually got sentenced?
Yeah, that was Ralph. That was the one who was who attempted to rape her, the one with the lighter hair. Jack was the one who framed Bill, who put the gun in his hand.
Yeah.
That's why I can't say he was the good one because he did that. But before that, he was kind of the better of the two. Ralph was the loose cannon.
I mean, wouldn't it have made sense if it ended with more with the sentencing of the overall, you know, the overlord,
the gangster?
I guess you could say. Yeah. Yes. The Godfather.
Maybe it was an early attempt at setting up a sequel. I don't know.
Oh.
One thing I didn't expect was Blanche's suicide. They're leading her to a jail, the jail cell, I suppose, and she sees a window and just runs for it.
I mean, it was just shy. The movie was just shy of having somebody, you know, putting a turkey in the crib and saying, well, where's the baby?
Yeah. Right.
You have to have somebody jumping off a building.
I guess.
Believing they could fly. Or, I mean, you know, whatever.
And again, his lines to camera from Miss Dr. Carroll, incredibly creepy. Because he just looks straight into the camera.
Right. There's a reason why people don't do that.
Yeah, yeah. And this movie demonstrates it perfectly.
Yes. Yes. What it did say more than anything was that, I mean, I should give Weed another try. Because, I mean... It sounded pretty wonderful. I remember being pretty dull, actually.
Uh-huh. On a sequels and remakes?
On a sequels and remakes.
Sean Albee's stage adaptation, Reefer Madness, ran for a year in Chicago in 92. The film was spoofed in a musical of the same name, which was later made into a made-for-television movie in 2005, which featured actors such as Alan Cumming, Kristen Bell, Christian Campbell, and Anna Gasteyer. That I've seen. In fact, when we were talking about whether or not we wanted to do the original, that was the not original that I was thinking of.
Yeah.
It's entertaining. In 2004, 20th Century Fox, in collaboration with Legend Films, released a colorized version on DVD. I don't know, the original just kind of lends to the charm, the black and white and the kind of, you know, iffy stock.
Well, right, and I mean, just the way this is cut and everything, mm-hmm. I mean, to make it in color just doesn't make any sense. Yeah.
It would be like colorizing Forbidden Zone, it would just take right. too much away from the movie. On to Brains?
On to Brains!
I had an absolute blast. Like I said, I think it might be a better unintentional comedy than The Room. I'm going 5.
There were some fun moments and stuff, but there was a lot that was just like, oh, really, man, can you just knock it off for a little bit? A lot of harshing of my buzz, honestly, so I'm going with a 3.
All right, and what have we learned?
If you're missing a tennis ball by 3 to 4 feet, I mean, that's got to be some primo shit.
Mm. And I learned that educators can't do anything until the public is sufficiently aroused.
Uh-huh.
I loved that one.
Why did we make that the intro?
Couldn't quite find a way to fit it in.
There's nothing to put zombie takeout in.
Exactly.
Exchange it. But damn it.
Yeah. All right. So until next time, we'll be concluding the Moral Panic trilogy. Yes, this was part 2 of the Moral Panic trilogy. I forgot to mention that. With Glenn or Glenda, recommended by Bodo Winter. Until then, go to zombietakeout.com, check out the album art, the episode description, of course, the episode itself, which you're already listening to, links to find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and YouTube, links to subscribe via RSS and iTunes. Please leave us a rating and review on iTunes. We'd really appreciate it. Also, if you enjoy the show, spread the word. Give us a solid word of mouth. Of course, we appreciate all of the listeners we have, but more would be better. You also find the movie list, every movie we've reviewed so far, and every movie we're going to review, in order up through, I'm going to say it's not quite there as of this moment, but I'm going to say Zombies.
Wow.
Because we have to do a two-parter with Zombievers and Zombies, and Zombievers is at the end.
That's a long way from now, though. I mean,
yeah, I'm thinking that's August, September, somewhere in there.
If we're lucky, I mean, that's like...
That's currently, without adding anything, yeah. Oh, side note, because I'm just thinking Prometheus is also toward the end. I heard some reviews of Covenant. A lot of action, but not very interesting beyond that.
I'm very intrigued that like Danny McBride is going to be in it.
And Franco, and apparently they don't have the usual Franco-McBride chemistry.
Huh. It's really weird to put him in, and yeah. It's not a comedy.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, you'll also find the recommendations list. I was pretty sure this was going to make it, because to me, this is what you were looking for last week. You know, so bad it's good.
It was still on the bad side.
Of course, you can email us, zombietakeout@gmail.com, or leave us a voicemail at 414-368-CTO1, or for the alphanumerically challenged. Nice. 414-368-9861. Of course, always remember that you will always be calling from the middle of Milwaukee. And until next time, always remember, never forget, wherever you go in life, there you are.
Well, what are you waiting for?
He said, Mazes of Monsters isn't anti-D... Mazes of Monsters is anti-D&D...